Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. How did I
Someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil. There's no place for ghost stories in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
Welcome back to Angel on Top. Just a few announcements before we get into the thin deadline.
We hope that all of you are safe and healthy and that your loved ones are safe and healthy too. This is absolutely the weirdest experience I've ever lived through, and I saw Nick Carter's solo tour. He made all his backup dancers wear full astronaut suits. It made absolutely no sense.
It was important to us to keep up with the podcast to allow for at least some small normalcy to remain in your routine. So even though Britt and I are not next to each other recording this time, we're actually many hours away, we're still going to keep talking about our favorite messy bitch, Angel. And if you find yourself gainfully employed or with some spare cash that you would like to share with those in the Buffering and Angel on Top communities that may have a greater need than you, Buffering has an amazing campaign going called Just Keep Fighting, where members of this community are donating, and then Jenny and Kristen are sending out money to others in the community who need help with their bills in this time of quarantine. So you can find that link at bufferingthevampireslayer.com/justkeepfighting.
Also, today, if you'd like some extra Buffering the Vampire Slayer content, they have dropped their Claire Kramer interview, which I personally cannot wait to listen to because I think Glory is one of the coolest big bads. Also, if you missed it, we dropped a new Angel on Pot episode a few weeks ago, exclusive to our Patreon supporters at any level. In this episode, Laura and I, Blueberry Edibles, discuss the second half of the Angel episode of Buffy Season 1. And as an extra treat, we made the first half of our discussion free to all listeners on our Patreon. So if you're curious about Angel on Pot or joining our Patreon community, you can find that episode now by going to patreon.com/angelontopcast.
Please stay safe. Please stay home if you can. And please take care of each other. Welcome back to Angel on Top, a podcast where we watch and discuss every episode of Angel one by one, spoiler-free, and in tandem with Buffering the Vampire Slayer. I'm Laura Zach.
And I'm Brittany Ashley, and this week we're watching The Thin Dead Line. Stick around until the end for an original poem written by us through the perspective of Angel.
The Thin Dead Line was written by Jim Koof and Sean Ryan and directed by Scott McGinnis. It aired on February 13th, 2001.
This is the one where Angel, Gunn, and Wesley battle zombie police officers who've been stalking street kids.
It's also the one where Angel's starting to miss his friends.
Laura.
Brittany, you're so far.
You're so far. I'm here.
Only if you think of yourself as the center.
Don't we all? Wouldn't it be weird if you were the center of my world?
Yes, that is correct. I am 3.5 hours away from LA. So this is the first time ever, I think, even since Sick or Sadder World, I think this is the first time we've ever recorded a podcast together, not together.
I know. It's actually quite sad.
But it's also because we're responsible adults who are staying at home and observing social distancing, as I'm sure many, if not all of you are, if you're able to. Solidarity. I do want to share that one thing I've been doing in quarantine is rewatching Buffy with my girlfriend.
You know,
she's watching it for the first time. And last night we got to Passion.
Oh, my God.
And here's the thing. She is like into Angelus.
Whoa.
Like she hates that she loves him, but she loves him. And, you know, and she's a therapist, and she was talking about it in kind of terms of how it's like he's hyper defended. Like as Angelus, it's actually he more so acts like he cares so much rather than not caring at all. And, you know, like with the how he like is still obsessed with Buffy and how he the best way to hurt her is to love her, and how it's almost like you could interpret his actions almost as like an extreme of caring rather than a lack of a soul.
Right. Well, yeah, because like a lack of a soul, you could think that it's like just apathy and total passiveness, whereas like he's incredibly active.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And fixated. But it's been very interesting and wild to experience the first Angelus reveal through fresh eyes.
Is she going to watch Angel after this or like in tandem?
Well, so she's been watching the episodes with me that I've been watching for this podcast. So she hasn't watched from the beginning of Angel. So she's been watching them kind of like out of context, and then simultaneously we're end of season two of Buffy right now.
Wow.
Yeah. Pretty crazy, but Buffy's been a big part of my world.
I wish I could re-experience Buffy with someone.
Maybe after this, you make a friend. I don't mean to say you need any more friends. I just...
Yeah, I'm full.
Also, we received a sweet treat from a listener. God.
Yeah, we received a Latin Angel jingle sent to us by Sam Strelkoff with artistic direction from his wife, Megan, which I will be playing for you right here. This is the part where angels speak
to our dead. Wow. I mean,
that's incredible. I mean, I love that quarantine has really just allowed some people to do projects that I think they've been putting off for a while. And I'm glad that the Latin Angel jingle could make its way onto someone's to-do list. So thank you, Sam and Megan.
Thank you so much. It's definitely falls into the category of something I didn't know I needed, but now I understand that I did.
Yeah, that's been a lot of quarantine discoveries. Yeah, I haven't been rewatching Buffy with anyone, but I have been taking a psychology class at Yale. So I go to Yale.
Oh, you go
now.
To Yale.
Yeah, I've been washing my face so much that my skin is utterly confused, and I've been reading a lot.
Anything good?
Yeah, I just finished In the Dream House by Carmen Machado, and I read it all in one sitting. I think that it is a total necessary read. It's awesome. I read The Battle for Paradise by Naomi Klein. That's all about the hurricane in Puerto Rico and how the relief efforts were so minimal, like to an absolutely insane degree, and how the community in Puerto Rico just had to kind of like band together because they were resigned to the fact that the United States was going to do absolutely nothing. Yeah, I've read a lot of goodies.
That's great. And then also, I think I know that you saw on socials as well, we had the pleasure of Violin Mick.
Oh my God, Violin Mick.
Sharing his art with us from Ireland. So essentially what happened is from the Angel on Top Twitter account, I retweeted that amazing video that was going around of that guy air drumming to the Buffy theme song. And I said, you know, someone should do the strings from the Angel theme song next. And then Violin Mick did a beautiful violin rendition of the Angel on Top theme song that then got the attention of both David Boreanaz and Charisma Carpenter, who reposted about it on Instagram. And then since then, Mick also has done
the Christoph Beck score,
the love theme, and the Buffy theme. He also mentioned that, you know, like many of us, he's going through a tough time in lockdown, and he is happy to do violin requests and commissions for a small fee. So he is at Violin Mick on socials. You can check out the Angel and Buffy covers that he's done with his violin on our socials. And hit him up if you want to support a musician and hear some of your favorite 90s television show theme songs come to life, or anything.
Or, I feel like, yeah, I think a You Ought to Know request is definitely a must.
Maybe this will be what I get everyone for Easter.
Yeah.
Oh, you liked that one. We have fun. Well, should we get into this episode?
I guess so. I will say that I'm watching everything through the brain of someone who is like just in quarantine brain, and like I'm looking at everything through the social distancing lens. But also I'm looking at it through the lens of the fact that Angel has an entire vacant hotel that he could open up to the unhoused people of Los Angeles. Like, he could put all of Anne's center in that fucking hotel.
I don't know that we've ever seen Angel go out of his way to inconvenience himself for some greater good. I feel like on a case-by-case basis, he's certainly, you know, fighting the good fight, at least when he's fully Angel and not Angle. But I don't know that we've seen him as much of a philanthropist.
Sure.
But yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's all this real estate that also he doesn't even need most of the day because he's underground.
No, not at all. And then when he's looking at the desk where Cordelia oft sit and he pushes all the books and the papers off the desk, it was just such like a dramatic teen acting out moment that I just really enjoyed.
Yeah. And what was that? Was that meant to be like him, you know, missing Cordelia and Gunn and Wesley coming off of the previous episode?
Yeah.
Or what?
Okay. Yeah, it was him being like, I can't look at it.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes these episodes start, especially this season, start with sort of like, what's the angst of the day? Like, yeah. What's the flavor of today's angst, Angel? Like, what's got you down? It could be one of three things, pretty much.
Yeah, it's like me on my period. What's going to become the worst thing in the world today? So Wesley is bored. He wants to be slaying demons, fighting crime, solving cases. And then this woman walks in with her daughter. She is one of Virginia's friends from the country club, which Cordelia is very into because that translates to money for her.
And Cordelia is wearing an incredible sunrise-themed shirt that really felt very of 2001 to me. And the daughter, Stephanie, has a bit of a problem, and that's that there is an eyeball embedded into the back of her skull. You know, relatable.
Yeah. I mean, how many times have I been through this trauma myself, you know? But something grabbed her, bit her, and then this appeared. And since they are the demon investigators in town, they got her biz.
And I hope you don't get too attached to finding out what caused this eyeball.
Because you won't in this episode.
And then we cut to two kids running on the street from a shadowy figure. It's not unlike the common scene we see of like a woman running into an alleyway. But in this case, it's two, you know, supposed teens, and they're running to Anne. Anne's back in this episode, and they're running to the shelter. They seem really scared of something, and they knock on the door, and essentially Anne's like, you know the rules, you didn't make it by a specific time, and now we're out of beds. But she can tell that the kids are really genuinely afraid of something, and so ends up letting them in.
Yeah, she kind of reminded me of Monica, the coach from Cheer, who's firm, and she's like, sorry, Lexi, you know the rules. You can't take drugs at the Bass Nectar concert and then come to practice. But then just like Monica gave Lexi another chance to join the squad and lets these two rabble-rousers in, seeing that they actually are fearing for their lives. And we also see that the money that she got from Angel clearly went to a good cause, because now she has this whole house for the teen center rather than just like this floor downtown.
She washed that blood right off.
Yeah.
And she's got Outkast Miss Jackson bumping.
Hell yeah.
Seems like a pretty chill place to be. And then we get a more intense than usual jump cut. And this episode in general is a real who's who of storylines and characters that we've kind of collected over the last few episodes. And
totally.
So we get some more Merle. None of us asked for it, but we get it.
But I asked for it. But before that, we see who the villain is that they were running away from.
And, yes, indeed. And
who would have thought it was a cop?
Yeah, I mean, could not have seen that coming. Yeah. A bad cop? Come on. Yeah, they're really going to lean hard into allegory around wicked cops and around police brutality in this episode. So Angel is still being a big old bully to Merle. Merle, much like his lover Brittany, loves fun facts. He's like, gonna tell me some fun facts about your friends. And he basically tells Angel that Wolfram and Hart is planning this big meeting tomorrow at 9:30.
Yeah, and he's also, Merle is being like, one, he wants to get out of the informant game. So I don't think that he really cares about being super nice to Angel. So he's like, how are those friends of yours that you fired a few episodes ago, huh? Like, how's your conscience dealing with that?
And also, do we even find out about this meeting he talks about?
This is like the first part of kind of like a 3-episode
arc.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, there's a lot that's not tied up here, but just trust that it will be.
And it's the next 2 episodes after this are absolutely batshit and I love them.
I can't wait. So we're back with Anne and she's talking to Kenny, the kid from the night before. And now Kenny, now that he's not actively in fear of his life, he's being kind of coy and like just not coming clean on what was scaring him.
Yeah, he's like, it was just the fuzz, man.
But he has a scar on his face and his friend that he's with is bruised up a little bit. And he finally admits that it was cops. You know, Anne is sort of like, okay, well, we obviously can't go to the cops with this because they are the problem. So who else could I go to? And then she decides to call upon an old friend. And this is when our worlds are going to start colliding because that old friend is gone.
Yeah, and you'd think it would be Angel. I think that's the misdirect that they were going for. But yeah, when she goes to see Gunn, it does make sense. You know, it's like they're both do-gooders. It's this small world of helping people within this community. And it also sounds like Gunn knew people who crashed at Anne's shelter or maybe has crashed there himself at some point. And I also kind of sensed a little love connection. Like maybe they hooked up once or twice.
Right. But one that's very
casual.
Casual, but also rooted in respect.
Totally.
Like it didn't feel like an objectifying, you know, it felt like they both genuinely like and respect each other.
Yeah, definitely. Which
was sweet to see.
Yeah, they would be a power couple.
Yeah. I mean, I ship it.
Mm-hmm. Gan.
Or Gunn-Anne.
No.
Or if you just merge the 2 N's in both of their names so that it's 4 N's, it would be Gunn.
Gunn.
And Anne kind of catches Gunn up with what's going on in a way that just kind of sounds like she's describing, in a lot of ways, like our present day American police, because she's just talking about cops attacking and beating on kids without provocation. Then she also is meeting Cordelia and Wesley for the first time in this scene because she's gone to Gunn's office to meet him. And Cordelia tells her about the Stephanie Eyehead thing and brings up that Angel is their former boss. So this is when truly we're starting to see this is the first time that Cordelia and Wesley and Gunn have heard tell of what Angel's been up to. And when they ask Anne about him, it's like they're asking about an ex.
Oh, I said the same exact thing.
They're just like all kind of hopeful at first. Like, oh, like, anyway, what's he been up to? Has he asked about me?
Yeah. He's like, nah, yeah. He like pulled some shady shit with Wolfram and Hart. And they're like, oh, damn it. He has not changed a bit.
Exactly. Back to cynical. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
He would.
But the thing is also to keep in mind that obviously Anne can't tell them that he gave her like all of this money. Like he did eventually end up doing the right thing because she can't tell them that. So she almost like has to lie, and that lie becomes like a prophecy fulfillment for them of what they believe the worst of Angel. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And then
I couldn't see your face.
Yeah, that was a thoughtful pause, not a skeptical one. But then Angel is on a nearby rooftop, Ever the stalker, watching Anne and Gunn leave together, which also is a little bit X of him.
Totally.
To be like, oh, wow, my like X is now hanging out with my like new friend.
That's very gay. Yeah, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. So Gunn goes to the teen center and the kids are like, the cops are tripping. And Gunn is like, Anne, can you please leave me with these kids for a second? I need to talk to them. And Gunn is protective of Anne. He is going into this conversation believing that the kids were doing something wrong and that they're trying to take advantage of Anne, and doesn't believe that the kids are just minding their business. And I will say that some of this dialogue sounds like it was written by some of the corniest white people on the planet. And I feel,
oh yeah,
I feel embarrassed that the actors had to say this.
Yeah, a lot of this episode definitely feels that way. Yeah. It feels like it's trying to, on the one hand, trying to address this like allegory about bad cops and about especially bad white cops who take advantage of communities of color and are violent and terrible. But then also within the storytelling, there's a lot of problems in its execution. And yeah, this scene, like I understand where Gunn's coming from, but also he's kind of victim blaming the kids. Like he's assuming that the kids are lying and that they actually did something to provoke the cops, which feels like a surprising position for Gunn to take, considering all of his collective experiences and considering that he's someone that functions outside of law enforcement because he knows not to trust the establishment.
Definitely.
Because they are not looking after his interests and the interests of his community.
Totally.
We see Angel walking alone and he comes head to head with one of these cops in question, and a cop stops him for no reason and tells him to face the fence and then wallops Angel really hard in the face with his crowbar.
Yeah. And he's reading Angel's Miranda rights as they're in a fight, but Angel ends up knocking him out, but then he's back up again. And Angel's like, okay, obviously this cop is not human. And then he roundhouse kicks his head off. Turns out, zombie cops.
Turns out his body turns decrepit when he gets killed. And we zoom in on the badge. Also, I love that you immediately referred to it as a roundhouse kick, because as I was watching this episode with my girlfriend, she pointed out, I was like, damn, he just kicked him right in the head. She goes, yeah, that's a roundhouse kick. So I guess I am not savvy on my fight moves.
Yeah.
Lingo.
First time.
First time for every roundhouse kick. Gunn brings in two of his guys who it's basically implied these are, you know, two of the men that he fights with in his downtown days, pre-working with Angel Investigation.
They kind of imply that Gunn has abandoned them for Cordelia and Wesley, basically.
Yeah, they give him shit for moving on up, essentially, or like, you know, kind of implying a little bit that he's selling out, but you can tell that they all have a close bond, and really it's probably coming from a place of hurt.
Yeah.
And missing him. And their plan is essentially to go out and lure the cops, and doing so essentially by being three black men, knowing that that will gain the attention of these unsavory zombie cops. And meanwhile, Angel goes to the precinct to chat with our girl, Kate, or I guess my girl, Kate.
Yeah, and she just started using some mousse.
Yeah, her hair looks great. I love that kind of tight curl she's got going on.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say it looks great, but it looks like hair.
Wow, Brittany, even in the time of quarantine, you have no compassion to spare for Kate. I will say.
I'm Corin Mean. I've turned Corin Mean.
Did you just make that up?
Yeah.
All right. I don't think this is a new position that you're taking on Kate, however.
No.
So I was surprised, though, because as you'll recall, the last time we saw Kate was her essentially giving Angel another chance. And it was in the episode where Darla and Drusilla were on their rampage through the city. And she basically chose to trust Angel slash Angle one last time when he implied that he would be able to stop them from their murdering. And we see here, like, as we saw in that episode, he did not end up doing that. No. He ended up letting them kill all of the Wolfram and Hart lawyers. And so Kate references that and is essentially like, yeah, crazy. There were two women in a clothing store that were found murdered and then a room full of lawyers. And she insinuates that he did not stop them like he said he would, but is kind of like not that pissed about it.
Yeah.
I think she's just at this point like resigned.
Yeah, there's like a passive aggression that Angle and Kate are both throwing back at each other. It's no longer vitriolic. It's more just like it's like an exhaustion maybe.
Yeah, but there is still something antagonistic about the way they go about it, especially Angel then being like, yeah, I just came because I killed a cop.
Yeah.
Like there's no reason that he needed to lead into it that way. He could have said, hey, by the way, there are zombies that are taking over cops' bodies. But well, I guess he didn't technically know that yet. but yeah, he definitely framed it in a way that was meant to be provoking to her.
Oh, 100%.
And sure enough, you know, she was like, I wouldn't make a joke like that if I were you in here, no matter how immortal you think you are.
So to figure out who this cop is, they go into the cop database. And
so convenient.
When I was trying to figure out what Kate's password was, I was like, maybe it's dad. Maybe it's daddy.
Maybe it's daddy's girl for EDA. Yeah.
But they find out that Officer Peter Harks was this cop who was provoking Angel, and he died 6 months ago. So
womp womp. Her password is daddy's daughter. Her password is daughter to a daddy.
Father's daughter. Daddy daughter. Daddy wasn't there.
So this is an interesting episode because it's essentially both, you know, the existing Angel Investigations crew of Cordelia, Wes, and Gunn at the same time as Angel trying to solve the same crime and the same demonic presence, which is the first time we've seen this happen.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was a cool way to show that they were both clearly unaware that they need each other. Like even at the very end, when Cordelia says, we don't need you, she has no idea that they actually probably would all be dead if Angel didn't stop the ritual from happening.
Right. Exactly. It's not energetically unlike Angelus after he turns in season two of Buffy, you know, like, he actually is still more obsessed with Buffy than ever, you know, despite his change in orientation. It's the whole, like, hatred is not the opposite of love. Apathy is.
Yeah.
And, yeah, all of these people are very in their extreme feelings toward each other right now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also an interesting way that they narratively in this episode chose to hint that these two, you know, separated parties are now getting closer and closer together to reuniting.
Mm-hmm.
And so Cordelia finds out from a call from Gunn his plan to essentially act as bait for these zombie cops. And she's really upset about this plan. Also, the reason that one of his friends brought the camcorder is that they're planning on catching it on film. Which in this like pre-Twitter era, I'm not really sure what that would do, because essentially at this point they don't know how far up the line at the police station this corruption goes. So I'm not sure who they would show that video to. But regardless, he wants to get footage and he wants to inspire one of these attacks. And Cordelia is really freaked out by this and worried for his safety. So she and Wesley basically choose to abandon the Stephanie Eyehead case to join forces with Gunn to try to make sure that he doesn't get himself killed.
Yeah, it was, I mean, one, to have this be taking place in Los Angeles where the Rodney King riots were, you know, less than a decade before that. And like the Rodney King riots were because it was one of the first times that people were able to see the like brutal racism that these cops had against unarmed black men. And it's like almost in 2001, the writers were more hopeful that the evidence of something unjust would change corruption.
Change anything.
Yeah, but obviously, as we live and breathe in 2020, we know that, you know, institutionalized corruption and racism and brutality can be documented, shared, seen, unveiled, and it rarely gets rectified by the people who are in power. So it's almost like looking back on this time capsule of like hopefulness that this could have changed something, and like being so cynical and jaded now and being like, I mean, it's not going to change any of the power structures, but you're definitely going to like change, you know, individual people's minds for sure. But like, you know, yeah, what their plan would have been like an interesting thing to unveil. But also, yeah, just being so like cynical now in 2020, it's hard to imagine what effect that would have had.
Yeah, damn. Yeah, that's it's a interesting gaze to have from this POV.
Totally.
So Kate brings Angel to the cemetery to show him the grave of this cop that he supposedly just killed. And Angel's able to tell from his vampire spidey sense that the gravesite has been recently disturbed and that actually they're in like a police specific cemetery. And he's able to see that a lot of the gravesites have been disturbed. And this freaks Kate out, and she rushes over to her dad's site, which I understand, like, maybe they didn't want to subject Kate to that much more trauma, but what a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, for lack of better words, that was really leaving the gun on the table by not going in the direction of zombie dead dad, who...
I would love to see zombie Trevor Lockley.
Yeah, who then Kate would have to kill, or fight, she would have to watch Angel kill. Like, it really would have spoken to the darkest parts of my soul, like... There's a storyline in season 2 of Jessica Jones. There's even kind of a storyline in Buffy season 5 with something like this as well. And like those storylines.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the dead parents coming back storylines are obviously something that really speaks to the darkness in me. And I thought they were going to go in that direction. I got really excited. But then, I mean, excited
and
is
also
a weird word, but.
No, I totally get what you mean. I feel like, why would they set up something that would be so rich? It also, because the rift between Angel and Kate was really solidified through her father's death, it would have been so interesting to see Kate have to fight a zombie version of her own father and essentially go through the motions of killing her own father. Like what if she had to do that to save Angel or something like that?
Totally.
If there'd be a way
to make a choice between
to find a karmic balance that maybe would allow her to forgive Angel.
Yeah.
For what happens.
And to like see that, you know, cause I think at the very end of this, she kind of starts to see that the world like isn't black and white. Yeah. I think it would have been really eye-opening for her and maybe would have allowed her to have more empathy for, yeah, Angel specifically.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Do you like science fiction? I'm Carrie Bechet, and if you loved movies like Arrival or Interstellar, then you're going to want to check out my podcast, Hypothetical. On Hypothetical, we tell speculative sci-fi stories interwoven with real science. New episodes every Tuesday, available wherever you get podcasts.
So then the merging of the worlds continues because Wesley and Cordelia show up at Anne's teen center, and Wesley goes off in the direction that Gunn went, and then Cordelia stays to help Anne out, and we get this really funny moment that is a callback to Blood Money,
the shirt,
where Cordelia is like, "That's my shirt," to one of the teens at the shelter, and we find out, of course, that the box of clothes that Angel had brought to Anne and Blood Money is Cordelia's clothes. We had some different theories about that. Were they Darla's? Were they like that actress he dated once? But it's established they're Cordelia's, but she very quickly has that sort of like self-consciousness of she knows enough. And, you know, Cordelia is not known for her tact, but she definitely has enough tact to know, like, you know what? This is not the hill I'm going to die on.
Yeah.
Didn't really like that shirt. I'm not going to take it from like a teen at this teen center.
Yeah.
A character named Kenny shows up and forces his way into the shelter. This is a character that I feel like they were trying to show, like, there are bad guys in this community too. Like, it was almost trying to, I don't know if it was trying to show, like, this is the type of character that these bad cops are after. Like, this is the what these bad cops were created in reaction to. But it just felt kind of like, it was not necessary to have this like racist trope of like this thuggy type guy.
Yeah.
It felt like they were trying to kind of pit Gunn and Jackson against each other as like the good black guy and the bad black guy. And like Gunn is the one who's more palatable and Jackson the one who's more like leaning into this life of crime. And I feel like they truly could have just done away with that, you know, storyline, and nothing would have been hurt in the overall plot.
Yeah, and it was super cringy when he was making these, like, kind of, like, sexual assaulty, sexual harassy lines, and Anne let him in anyways. Like, there was, yeah, there was, like, that was a really cringy part of the episode, for sure.
And we check back in with Gunn and his friends with the camcorder, and sure enough, a really creepy cop approaches who's like tapping his nightstick against the building as he's approaching in this really creepy way. They did a good job of like really playing up the kind of soulless zombie aspect of these cop characters.
At first you had to be like, is he a zombie or is he racist?
Right. Like, is he a zombie or just like a real police officer? And as the cop's about to attack, Wesley comes in very much as sort of the like clueless white character bystander who's like, oh, cop, you have a misunderstanding. Like, you know, thinking he's going to reason with this guy.
And then bam.
And then straight up gets shot. Wesley gets shot.
Yeah, Wesley gets shot in the stomach.
The three other guys start fighting the cop, and then one of Gunn's friends shoots the cop, which I was really glad in this moment that the cop was a zombie because he pops right back up. Like, I'm glad they didn't take it in a direction
like a
of
Queen
like
and Slim direction.
Right. Like, now this black man is going to be blamed for killing this cop when really it was self-defense. Then we see the cop who survives calling it in, and he says, we've got witnesses, I need backup. So now we understand even more so that this is part of a larger conspiracy and a larger network of zombie cops happening in LA.
Yeah.
And Wesley is badly wounded. And I really loved I just loved Gunn in this episode in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I really loved his friendship with Wesley. You know, it was intensified through this injury. And I think too, Angel's absence in the last several episodes has allowed Gunn to establish his place in a deeper, intimate, bonded way with Cordelia and Wesley, whereas before Angel was the person they have in common, now they're creating their own relationship that's totally unique from Angel and doesn't need Angel.
Yeah, and like they got closer because Wesley, in some level you could say, kind of took a bullet for Gunn in a way. And so it proved this loyalty that Wesley has for Gunn. And then Gunn when Gunn wants to ride with Wesley in the ambulance, it was just so sweet because you remember how much they were irritated by each other. And Wesley didn't even want, you know, he was even questioning if he wanted like Gunn to get paid at some point. Like, these two are actually very bonded because of what they care about and how they care about each other.
Absolutely. And then we see Angel and Kate at a different precinct. I guess it's the evil cop precinct. I'm unclear how they found this because they went straight from the cemetery to here, but they've essentially found where the captain of these zombie cops are. And we realize that this is not just a network of zombies. This is head by mortals. So yeah. Like the captain who has orchestrated all of this is a living human, which I'm glad they did it that way. So it implied that there is, it wasn't just like all cops are good cops except for ones that are undead.
Yeah.
It's that there is this corruption and racism
starts at the top
within. Yeah. Yeah, within the existing structure, and that then they're using the bodies of dead cops to inflict their new order. Mm-hmm. You know, Kate basically is there speaking her kind of like cop speak of like wanting to enter a complaint about how cops are handling things in this precinct. Wesley is in a bad way. He's losing a lot of blood, and the ambulance arrives and, you know, Gunn goes with him, but they are not going to
make it very far.
No, because they get closed in this really terrifying moment by all of these cop cars. And of course, the EMT, not knowing that these are evil cops, you know, gets out to be like, hey, we need to pass, and then immediately gets shot. And then Gunn has to take over driving the ambulance and drives it like crazy to the shelter. I think at this point, he's afraid that like, they'll get followed to the hospital. I'm not really sure. I think he just assumes at this point, like, if all of the cops in this area are under this demonic influence, then no institution feels safe right now.
Yeah.
So he just goes where he knows he trusts someone, and that's Anne in the shelter, even though Wesley's, you know, on the edge of holding on to his life right now.
Yeah, definitely. This episode was just so intense. Like, there were so many like action elements to it and so many little like twists, because like, you don't know, like, I didn't know what was going to happen at every turn, because it's like, what do you do when these institutions that are meant to protect you, not only are they not going to help you, but they're actually like against you and trying to kill you. And it felt very bleak and very relatable, you know, that like, there are, you know, Republican politicians who could have told the public about this much sooner and like flattened the curve much sooner, but instead they decided to capitalize off of disaster and sell stock, buy new stock that would benefit them in a pandemic. But like, reading The Battle for Paradise by Naomi Klein, which I said that I had read, that's about the destruction in Puerto Rico, it's like, they're like, the hopeful part is that there are enough people willing to take care of each other who are all in this fight together and who all band together, because like, that know that a system will stop working, and as humans you like have to find new ways to work with each other. Oops. And like, we have to keep each other safe, because they're like, the powers that be are not going to. And so there was something just very like relatable to the moment with this episode.
Right. Absolutely. And even the way they talked about, I think I just have COVID on the brain.
Yeah.
Although obviously, as we all do, not literally, thankfully, I am well so far. But even the way that then when the Gunn and Wesley go into the shelter for safety, like, one of the cops pulls out front and he's like, all passengers on board, we have full containment, wait for backup, secure the entire section and clean house. Like, it feels like this forced quarantine.
Yeah.
Which I feel like we've seen something like this happen a lot in Buffy, especially. I feel like there's a few different episodes of sort of, you know, the core group being trapped in and surrounded on all sides by the enemy, and like it seeming really unlikely that they're going to be able to get out. But it seems clear that in some ways this was orchestrated by these zombie cops so that they could get the largest subsection of the community that they hate. And, you know, which includes a lot of like homeless kids and homeless kids of color, and wipe them out in one fell swoop. And even as Wesley's dying, he's still like in this denial mode about what just happened, of like, he had no right, you know, saying that to Gunn about the cop. Like, you know, he's still not quite getting that this is like incredibly normal for Gunn and his friends to experience. Yeah, it's just this really scary moment where they're trying to keep everyone away from windows and lock all the doors. They're just like these marching zombie cops, like surrounding on all sides. And in the meantime, Angel has gone into the captain's office. So again, like without Cordelia and Wesley and Gunn knowing, Angel is the one who's literally about to save them.
Mm-hmm.
And Angel's in the captain's office and is basically like, we need to talk. And the cop shoots Angel in the chest, which, as we know, is not going to work.
Yeah, it's like, get a new move.
Yeah, ever heard of wooden bullets, dude? but I don't quite understand how Angel knew that it was Granith, the zombie god, that was going to be the thing that needed to be destroyed. Did you pick up how he figured it out that it was that like icon that needed to be destroyed to stop them?
No.
All right, we're just going to roll with that. Like, maybe if they had, you know, I understand they wanted to set something up that is going to be played out in the next two episodes, but maybe if they spent less time on like eye in the back of her head girl, we could have gotten a little bit more, you know, justification for some things that happened in this episode. But regardless, basically we cut back and forth of these zombie cops about like starting to make their way in, breaking through the windows, and like Anne and Cordelia working together to beat them back, all the kids helping.
Yeah, I mean, everyone was like very good in this crisis situation. Like, I'd say that they were all really like put together about all this while it was going on. I mean, except for Diego, RIP. But they're all like trying to save each other. Cordelia has that hammer.
And Jackson gets on board finally. Like, he's, you know, after a little bit of like a moment where he's more self-interested, he then, you know, for survival purposes, joins with Gunn and helps him. And yeah, and then essentially they're in, Angel's in like the captain's worship room,
the shrine,
with all
yeah.
these like creepy shrines
where he
of the
jerks
dead cops.
Off to cops. Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, no homo, but these are my brothers in blue. No homo, but I would sacrifice my
no
body.
No homo, but I come blue.
Oh, sick, Brittany.
What?
You just always know how to walk up to the edge and then go one step too far, and I love you for it. You're my sister in blue. No, just kidding. So basically, Angel.
These are all my daughters.
No, it would be, in his case, it's all men. So it's like, these are all fathers of daughters. Angel, who is in his vamp face, finds Granith, the zombie god, an idol, like a statue of him. And he gives this hilarious smile, who's just sort of like, oh, I wonder what this does.
Yeah.
And then crashes it on the captain's head. And back at the shelter, all of the zombie cops fall to the ground and disintegrate, or well, rather turn back into corpses. Yeah, without realizing how that happened and without realizing that Angel saved them, Cordelia and Gunn shift their focus back to Wesley and helping him. Oh, before we get into these final couple scenes, shall we do a quarantine edition of Fuqua?
Ooh, I'd love that.
Flirting, understanding, consent, and kissing. Flirting, understanding, consent, and kissing.
Fuqua. Sure, I mean, this one wasn't very hard for me. I think that a character that really got to shine in this episode, who really stepped forward as a true leader and had incredible grace and poise in times of duress was Gunn.
Mm-hmm.
Our boy Gunn. And I do not believe I've picked him yet this season. So I'm going to go with Bunn.
I'm going to go with Butt.
Although also, I feel like my second choice would be a threesome with Gunna. Which, of course, is our celebrity couple name for Gunn and Anne, and it has four N's.
Yeah. So my pick was someone who, you know, didn't get a lot of lines but played a major role in life-saving, is the paramedic who did not get shot, who had no qualms about letting Gunn take the wheel, was kind of like cool with the idea of taking care of Wesley at this teen center because he just wanted to help save a life. He didn't really care what, like, where he was or what was going on around him. His number one priority was taking care of Wesley's wound and making sure he stayed alive. And I think that everyone in the healthcare industry right now really deserves so much love because they are heroes right now.
Absolutely. It's very sexy when someone abides by their Hippocratic oath.
Hell yeah.
So we get a final scene with Angel and Kate where I feel like he was a little bit self-satisfied when he's like, took care of our little cop problem, which also, even in this moment of celebrating that they defeated the big bad, Angel's still being a little bit passive aggressive. Like, even the fact that he frames it as like our little cop problem, knowing that like this is Kate's passion.
Yes. Yeah.
And we get a rare moment of a little bit of vulnerability from Kate where she, you know, shares that this job is making her feel crazy.
Yeah. You know, her dad is a cop. So she grew up her whole life believing that cops and this institution is the correct, you know, like they are correct. And the, you know, these like Gunn and these kids at the teen center, they are criminals. And so to see that that's not exactly how it is, I think is just like, it's not that the job is making her crazy. I think she's just seeing the world from a different perspective and it's making her feel kind of insane. Like it gets when your world, it's like when your world expands and you're like, holy shit.
Yeah. And I think that dissonance is also mirrored for her with Angel and the supernatural realm as well, that she we've seen her be such a black and white thinker in many ways, and we've seen her be very overly simplistic and rigid in her belief systems, and that also applies to how badly she took finding out that Angel was a vampire and how, you know, quick she had been to demonize him and everything that he stands for, even though she knows that he is good.
Yeah.
So she's grappling with a lot in that Lockley brain of hers. Then someone drops off a file at her desk and it's about Wyndham Price, and that's Wesley, of course, and that's how Angel finds out that Wesley was shot.
Yeah. So we're at the hospital. Wesley wakes up and Gunn is there waiting for him when he wakes up. And again, it's like, it's really one of the first times that we see how much they care for each other. And I think that's when they kind of realize it too. And like Wes on morphine is just such a mood. It rules.
And Cordelia sees Angel lurking around
the hospital
outside of Wesley's room. And, you know, is not, at least does not present as being happy to see him. She's like, too bad it took a gunshot wound to make you give a crap. And she says, like you alluded to earlier, we don't need you. Do us a favor and stay away. And of course, you know, unbeknownst to her, they did need her. They always have. They do. And the whole reason they're alive right now is because of Angel, which has happened, lost track of how many times. And then she goes in to rejoin Wesley. So you know, I definitely think that this is, you know, suggesting that there's going to be, you know, there's a long road ahead toward healing this, but it seems like we're on the path there.
Yeah. I mean, do I think that Cordelia delivered some harsh barley? I do. Like her basically being like, I'm going to go join my family now. Go away. You're not part of it. Like, it's clear now that they are making Cordelia the, like, hardest cookie to crack, I guess you could say. And it makes the most sense. I mean, she has the most history with him, and she has changed more than anyone else in order to do this job. Like, it does make sense, but it was just some roof stoof.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Angel on Top. I'm Laura Zack, and you can find me on Instagram at Laura Zack or on Twitter at @la_wa.
And I'm Brittany Ashley, and you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Brit27Ash.
And you can follow Angel on Top on Instagram and Twitter at AngelOnTopCast. And you can email us at AngelOnTopPodcast@gmail.com.
And now please enjoy the poem For the Thin Deadline. From Angel's perspective.
The Thin Deadline. My sewer lackey tries to dodge me. Hey Merle, loyalty's required. He wounds me more than I let on, calling my once family ones I fired. Speaking of which, I'm due for a check-in on a rooftop lurking round. Guess the new gal knows my exes. LA really is a small town. I'm in no mood for hassle from one of Kate's boys in blue. Only thing worse than a demon's a mortal telling me what to do. I make quick work of attack with a roundhouse kick to the head. Plot twist I didn't see coming, this cop's already dead. Maybe an unlikely choice, but my next stop's police station. No love from Kate since I botched her investigation. But she's all ears when I say I'm here for homicide, not a whim. I killed a cop, I tell her, the kind that still talks after you've killed him. At the officer's cemetery, burial grounds, been bothered. To Kate's great relief, one left untouched is her father's. Racism and undead zombie flesh, frankly, it all stinks. So we go to see Captain Corrupt down at the precinct. A power-tripping mortal talking good cops versus scum. Biggest scumbag I've met today just shot me in the chest. Of course he worships creepy shrines and an icon of granite, but a wallop to his head puts Captain and all his cronies to rest. Took care of our little cop problem. Kate's questioning her career. I don't blame her. But when I learn Wyndham Price has been shot, the rest becomes a blur. Till I'm at his bedside. Well, technically, looking in. At gun with access, I'm no longer allowed. Cordelia says they don't need me. Do them a favor and get lost. But still, I saved them, and for that, I'm proud.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.